Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This is my opinion and my opinion only, perhaps in the entire cosmos. I call it Children of Satan. August 13th is International Left-Handedness Day, which is sort of a sop to us left-wingers, like a still-delayed promise to apologize to blacks for 3 centuries of slavery. Studies apparently demonstrate that 50% of babies not born with a right-handedness gene wind up lefties, which seems similar to humans not born with a certain chromosome doomed to be males. Most of our problems with being left-handed are political and cultural rather than intellectual or psychological, though those problems are societal in origin. I don't know why most people are right-handed. Because they are, the right hand is the hand of sustenance and labor, and the vile left hand began its evil reputation in ancient times when it was used to clean away the body's excrement. Thus, from antiquity has developed a sophisticated aversion to the left side of things. Prejudice against people who are left-handed predates more familiar bigotries of race, religion, nationality, gender, and homophobia. In every culture before record, all that is good and righteous has been accorded the right hand, while everything evil, ugly, wrong-headed, or simply clumsy, not to mention bad luck, is the left. My first exposure to the prejudices against lefties was religious. When I started Catholic school more than 50 years ago, the nuns were still righteously forcing southpaws to switch. I am not sure I will ever really know why I resisted changing hands, except being a lefty was what I was, which prompted the nuns to crack my left knuckles and wrist with rulers and tie my left hand behind my back to force me to write right-handed. Finally, I was isolated as Son of Satan in my classroom, and misbehaviors were punished by sitting next to me. That was my first and most lasting impression of how easily intolerance is bred and nurtured, and how relentlessly cruel the righteous can be. In politics as well as society, a crude bicameral cleft has been made between left and right. The established order that resists change is the political and cultural right, which usually defends itself with tradition, religion, and autocratic power. The political left is the force of change and reform that calls upon the future instead of the past and explores new ideas and innovative social and political approaches to greater freedom and well-being of the common citizenry. Left is about justice, not privilege. The left is the opposition. Once in power, it automatically reverts to the right. The oldest struggle after survival is for freedom, of being part of a community, not enslaved by it. The eternal, pitiless struggle between haves and have-nots. The despairing rage of those condemned to live bitterly wretched lives in the shadows and as menials to the economically and politically aristocratic elite who are in their turn angrily terrified by this rage. History shrieks with the pain of injustice, only briefly muffled by excesses of gross brutality. Sometimes the oppressed overthrow or forcibly reform their lords and bosses, but elites always rise in even the most originally classless societies. If the American Revolution is accepted as more than a revolt of colonial bourgeoisie, and that it gave birth to an essentially egalitarian society in which the common citizenry had a chance to be their own rulers, it should also be realized that every reform has been bitterly and often bloodily fought and adopted only with great reluctance. Reforms that have been adopted are usually countered with vicious backlash. Think 14th Amendment. for all the problems Western democracies have had with communism and socialism, words that mean community and society when stripped of ideological abstraction, the ideas at their roots grew as alternatives to rapid industrialization in the 19th century, demanding in philosophy, if not practice, more than servitude for the mushrooming working classes as their share for producing the technological revolution throughout Western Europe and North America. Fascism and Nazism is an extreme right-wing reaction to these leftist heresies of class, i.e. social and political parity. That communist and socialist societies generally become totalitarian states of the political right should not repudiate the underlying perception shared with the democracies, themselves flawed and corrupt, that there is enough for everyone and everyone is equal under law. Reform, resistance, and rebellion to contemporary rule in the United States has since at least the Russian Revolution been called by the assaulted authority leftist, a sinister, from Latin sinus meaning left or unlucky, hint at Bolshevik conspiracy, a suspicion of alien agents or homegrown dupes of foreign strategies to destroy the American way of life operating within its very heart. In other words, dissent and resistance to authority and or injustice in this land of liberty and justice is implied to be treachery. Perhaps because of ancient and immediate hostility toward left-handed people, we are usually supporters of underdogs and outcasts and feel personally sympathetic to ideals of personal and political liberty. Left-handed people share with women and minority races and religions, not to mention people with physical and mental handicaps, the problems of survival in a world designed with no consideration for their presence in it, or much worse, designed to eradicate their presence. And that was Children of Satan, which I wrote, celebrating my being left-handed. When people call me a leftist, I say, right out of the oven. I'd like to read something that Bob Herbert, a columnist for the New York Times, wrote recently, and it was reprinted in last Thursday, August 5th's Daily Astorian. And by the way, a friend of mine just turned 6 on August 5th. Her name is Winter. I was just talking to her grandmother on the phone a few minutes ago. And her name is Julie. Her birthday is on VJ Day, August 14th. She's a bit older than her granddaughter, Winter. It's called It's Time to End the Madness, Bring GIs Home. The Army, to its credit, tells the story of a middle-aged lieutenant colonel who had served multiple combat tours and was suffering the agonizing effects of traumatic brain injury and dementia. He also had difficulty sleeping. Several medications were prescribed. On a visit to an emergency room, he was given a 30-tablet refill of Ambien. He went to his car and killed himself by ingesting the entire prescription with a quantity of rum. He left a suicide note that said his headaches and other pain were unbearable. And if there is not enough that has gone tragically wrong in this era of endless warfare, the military is facing an epidemic of suicides. In the year that ended September 30th, 2009, 160 active duty soldiers took their own lives, a record for the Army. The Marines set their own tragic record in 2009 with 52 suicides. And this past June, another record was set, 32 military suicides in just 1 month. War is a meat grinder for service members and their families. It grinds people up without mercy, killing them and inflicting the worst kinds of wounds imaginable, physical and psychological. The Pentagon is trying to cope with the surge in suicides, but it is holding a bad hand. The desperate shortage of troops has forced military officials to lower the bar for enlistment, thus letting in people whose drug and alcohol abuse or other behavioral problems would previously have kept them out. And the multiple deployments, 4, 5, and 6 tours in the war zones, have jacked up stress levels to the point where many just can't take it. The GIs have fought valiantly in Iraq and Afghanistan. Thousands have died and many, many more have suffered. But the wars have been conducted as if their leaders had been reading from a lunatic's manual. This is not Germany or Japan or the old Soviet Union that we're fighting. But after nearly a decade, neither war has been won and there is no prospect of winning. Trillions of dollars are being squandered. George W., mission accomplished, Bush took the unprecedented step of cutting taxes while waging the wars. And Barack Obama has set a deadline for withdrawing troops from Afghanistan without having any idea how that war might be going when the deadline arrives. This is warfare as it might have been waged by Laurel and Hardy. Absent the bloodshed, it would be hilarious. I'd give a lot to hear Dwight Eisenhower comment on the way these wars have been conducted. July was the deadliest month yet for American troops in Afghanistan. 66 were killed, which was 6 more than the number who died in the previous most deadly month, June. The nation is paying little or no attention to these deaths, which is shameful. The president goes to fundraisers and yucks it up on The View. That's a television show. For most ordinary Americans, the war is nothing more than an afterthought. We're getting the worst of all worlds in Afghanistan. We're not winning, and we're not cutting our tragic losses. Most Americans don't care because they're not feeling any of the tragic losses. A tiny, tiny portion of the population is doing the fighting, and those troops are sent into the war zone for tour after tour, as if they're attached to a nightmarish yo-yo. Some kind of shared sacrifice is in order, but neither Bush nor Obama called on Americans to make any real sacrifices in connection with either of these wars. The way to fight a war is to mobilize the country, not just the combat troops, behind an integrated war effort. To do that, leaders have to persuade the public that the war is worth fighting and worth paying for. What we have in Afghanistan is a war that most Americans believe is not worth fighting, and certainly not worth raising taxes to pay for. President Obama has not made a compelling case for the war and has set a deadline for the start of withdrawal that seems curiously close to the anticipated start of his 2012 campaign for a second term. It's time to bring the curtain down for good on these tragic, farcical wars. The fantasy of democracy blossoming at the point of a gun in Iraq and spreading blithely throughout the Middle East has been obliterated, and it's hard to believe that anyone buys the notion that the United States can install a successful society in the medieval madness of Afghanistan. For those who haven't noticed, we have a nation that needs rebuilding right here at home. Maybe we could muster some shared sacrifice on that front. It's time to bring the troops back and nurse the wounded and thank them all for their extraordinary service. It's time to come to our senses and put the lunatic's manual aside. And that was by Bob Herbert of the New York Times. And I concur with him 1,000%. We had a number of suicides around Vietnam. Of course, they played the body count number and exaggerated the count, but there have been considerable, including some very close friends of mine who fought like hell to stay alive in the war and just couldn't pull it off in the peace when they got home. I'd like to read something that Louis Alvis wrote for the North Coast Times Eagle back in October 1990. He used to be here, called himself the Volunteer, if anybody remembers him. And he wrote this, the Oil War Memorial. The Oil War Memorial should be black. It's a good color for war memorials. Black for the color of crude oil. black for the hearts of those whose greed demands lives, black for the filth they have smeared in our skies, bled on our beaches, excreted across our economies. It should soar above our heads like the Washington Monument or the Statue of Liberty. Its awesome mass will remind us of how small we puny citizens are to the privileged few. Those persons in government and industry who decided decades ago, and now, that we should follow the policies of waste and greed. A broad cylinder of featureless black, gently rimmed at a few regular spaces down its length. A vast oil drum, perhaps a reflecting pool of the turgid liquid at its base. There should be no names on this one. Already its victims number in the billions. Billions whose lives have been adversely affected by the renewed frenzy over energy costs. Where is room for all those names? The monument should be in the center of a great circular amphitheater. It should be able to seat thousands to remind us of how we all watched the Gulf War unfold on the flickering blue eye, and now the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our government does not need to put things in our houses to watch us. They know where we are every night, and they tell us all what to believe. It would be hard to send a replica of this memorial all around the country as we did with the Vietnam Memorial. Instead, we could remember the war by re-educating ourselves. We could teach each other how to break the addiction to waste. And that was the Oil War Memorial by Louis Alvis, which I thought appropriate to follow Bob Herbert's article about the Lunatic's Manual. And now I would like to read something from the New York Times from back in June. It's in regards to the death of Tony Judde. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name. It's either Jut or Jute. Telling me how to pronounce it, J-U-T-T, in the New York Times really wasn't all that help. So I'm going to go with Jute. And he and his son had a bit of a dialogue about the future. Now, if you listened to Terry Gross yesterday on Fresh Air, you might have heard that at least half her program was devoted to a March interview she had with him on her program about dying of ALS and what it was like. And also the fact that he was a really good political writer and historian. He crossed all kinds of lines, and he never seemed to lack the courage to speak his mind. And you might find this in this article here that I'm going to read, Generations in the Balance, by Daniel Judde and Tony Judde. And Daniel is 14. That's his son, Daniel. Had I been 18 in November 2008, I would have voted for Barack Obama. However, being 14, I settled for voicing my support for him and expressing joy at his election. I believed, innocently, that his administration would put its foot down, stamping out the environmental crisis that his predecessors had allowed to fester unnoticed. I felt Mr. Obama knew how to do the right thing morally, even if it meant going against the right thing politically. Less than 2 years later, I have become hugely pessimistic about the moral resolve of our government and corporate world. Deepwater Horizon has been the tipping point. I was already skeptical. An increase in offshore drilling, our government's passive stance at Copenhagen, and the absence of any environmental legislation saw to that. But BP made me realize that the generation in office just doesn't get it. They see the environmental crisis in the same light as they see political debacles and economic woes. Politics pass and economies rebound, but the environment doesn't. It's that sense of, we'll get that done right after we have dealt with everything else, that makes me so angry. The world is not an expendable resource. Fixing the damage you have inflicted will be the issue for my generation. It is that simple. His father, Tony Judde. Well, I am 62, and I did vote for Barack Obama. I held out no great hopes. It was clear from the outset that this was someone who would concede rather than confront, and that's a shortcoming in a politician, if not in a man. We have seen the consequences, not in the Middle East, nor in the economic regulation, nor over detainees, nor in immigration reform, as Mr. Obama followed through. The audacity of hope? As for the corporations, we baby boomers were right to be cynical. Like Goldman Sachs, oil companies are not benign economic agents serving a need and taking a cut. They are, in Theodore Roosevelt's words, malefactors of great wealth. But our cynicism dulled our response to truly criminal behavior. They would do that, wouldn't they? It's one thing to watch while Goldman Sachs pillages the economy, quite another to be invited to stand aside while BP violates the Gulf Coast. Yes, we should be a lot angrier than we are. We are staring into our future, and it does not work. The gush of filth is a reminder that we have surrendered our independence to a technology we cannot master. Our energies are misdirected to expensive foreign wars whose purposes grow ever more obscure. We rail at one another in cultural clashes irrelevant to our real problems. Meanwhile, the clockwork precision of our classical constitution has ground to a halt, depending as it does on a consensus that no longer exists. Taking the long view, this is how republics die. Someone clearly has to do something. What do you propose? Daniel, just as you are too forgiving of unacceptable corporate behavior, maybe you are too resigned politically. To actually affect change, you need to come in thinking that real change is possible. My generation saw things that way. That is why so many young people supported Mr. Obama. Perhaps more than any other constituency in the United States, we believe that engagement would make things happen. But the more we are told that crises are to be expected and cannot be prevented by those in power, that we must put our faith in God, as the president advised on Tuesday, this is in March, or in June, pardon me, the more our faith in government slips away. Politicians depend on the public. Given a strong enough consensus, they will act. That's what I would build, a consensus and act. Your generation talked a lot about engagement, so engage. Use the lever of public opinion to force strong environmental legislation. In reconciling ourselves after BP to getting back to normal, we will have missed a vital opportunity. We need a new normal, and we need to ask ourselves new questions, not whether we can afford to invest in a different way of life, solar energy, mass transportation, the phasing out of our dependency on oil, but how long we can afford not to. You owe us this. Tony, I am a little queasy about all this generation talk. After all, I am the same age as Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, but I take no responsibility for them. Actually, while I agree that we need to build a national consensus, I don't think the challenge is to convince Americans about pollution or even climate change, nor is it just a matter of getting them to make sacrifices for the future. The challenge is to convince them once again of how much they could do if they came together, but that requires leadership. And I can't help noticing that you rather let the president off the hook. After all, if you and your contemporaries have lost faith in the man and the system, that's partly his fault. But you, too, have a responsibility. Coming together to elect someone is not enough if you then go back to texting and Twittering. You have to stay together, know what you want, and fight for it. It won't work the first time, and it won't work perfectly, but you can't give up. That, too, is politics. You are wrong to think that I have lost faith in government. Big government built this country. Without it, there would have been no transcontinental railroad. Land-grant colleges, the glory of American public education, were the work of the Morrill Acts of 1862 and 1890. The nation invested substantial sums of money for the public good. Remember the Marshall Plan, the GI Bill, and the interstate highways, without which our post-war economy could never have boomed as it did? And don't forget the Civil Rights Act, a hugely controversial moral revolution that took great political courage. I have not lost faith in government, but I worry about whether today's politicians are up to the challenge. Daniel, you're right. I do let the president off a little. But to have so many young people help elect a government after years of skepticism is no small feat. He almost single-handedly instilled political vigor in those of us who knew only shame over the previous administration. Without that surge of hope and thirst for action, it is very possible that most members of my generation would have abandoned politics in disgust before they even began. For that mobilization, we have Mr. Obama to thank. Of course, he deserves criticism. What we must not do, both as a generation and as a nation, is to let our disillusion devolve into pessimism and laziness. What we now face is a moral challenge from which we cannot back down. I was afraid that in your skepticism you had lost faith and given up. You have to admit that the radicalism of your generation never quite lived up to its potential. You always say that politics is the art of the possible. But if we could turn our anger into positive action, then surely the possible becomes a whole lot more probable. Is anger a wise guide to action? Admittedly, if used for the wrong causes or taken the wrong way, it can be disastrous. But isn't it better than sitting back and complaining while we are led over the edge? Tony. Yes, it is not beyond us to sacrifice in the present for long-term advantage, to set aside the pursuit of quarterly economic growth as the supreme goal of public policy. We offer ourselves easy choices, high taxation or free markets, and are then surprised to learn that they do not speak to our needs. Technological fixes are the hubris of our time. But as the folks at BP have helpfully demonstrated, there is a limit to how many caps you can put on a leak. Sometimes you need to start afresh. The challenge goes beyond oil slicks and moral revulsion. In the bigger picture, big oil has no long-term future. Sooner or later, the contemptible little sheikdoms that have arisen upon a pool of liquid greed will sink back into the desert. But why should BP and the emirs script the end game? Nothing man-made is inevitable. Chinese capitalism, unregulated profit accompanied by serial environmental catastrophe, is not the only possible future. The president spoke of pressing forward with congressional legislation, but at the moment that amounts to little more than cap and trade, a shell game for corporations that has been tried in Europe and already been found wanting. What we need is a Marshall Plan for the 50 states, federal money raised from defense savings and, yes, taxes. A loan to our successors, should be made available on condition it is spent on public infrastructure, mass transit, renewable energy, and education. Anything less is unworthy of the crisis that a 60,000-barrel-a-day leak has unleashed. Are you up to it? If you want to change the world, you had better be willing to fight for a long time, and there will be sacrifices. Do you really care enough, or are you just offended at disturbing pictures? Daniel. We have no choice but to care enough. The sacrifices you foresee are nothing compared to the ones we will be forced to make if we sit back and wait. Most important, we don't have the luxury of fighting for a long time. Look, we are powerless and will be for a while to come. In fact, we are in the worst possible position. We are old enough to understand better than you what has to be done, but far too young to do it. All we can do is say it. And that was an interview by Rachel Sumter of Daniel Jute and his father, Tony Jute. Daniel is in the 9th grade at the Dalton School. Tony, who finished the book recently, Ill Fares the Land, died this last Friday of ALS.